This is Peace Talks, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. The U.S. military pays a modest wage to volunteer soldiers who are willing to take up arms and risk their lives in war-torn regions of the world. Could there also be an international peace force that would pay a modest wage to volunteer peacemakers willing to take unarmed peacemaking strategies into conflict regions? Well, there already are a few such initiatives. One is called the Nonviolent Peace Force. Formed in 2002, it's pilot testing its methods in Sri Lanka, where civil war and recently an assassination of a high-level government official has created a demanding proving ground for the organization. Today on Peace Talks, a spotlight on the work of the Nonviolent Peace Force. Here's our host, Carol Boss.
I'm happy to be talking today to Mel Duncan of Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's the executive director of the Nonviolent Peace Force. Welcome, Mel.
Thank you, Carol. I appreciate being here.
Can I ask you to relate a short story or anecdote that will give listeners right off the bat insight into the work of Nonviolent Peace Force?
Our pilot project has been up and running for a year and a half in Sri Lanka. In that country, tragically, there is a rampant use of child soldiers. Last summer, a group of mothers whose sons had been kidnapped during a temple festival came to one of our teams and said that they had had enough, that they wanted to go after their children. This is extraordinary in Sri Lanka for a couple of reasons. Number one, there's a deep culture of silence. And secondly, often the price one pays is another child if they speak up. But these mothers decided that they were going after their sons. They came to our team. Very quickly, we were able to determine where the children were being held and trained in the jungles and accompanied the mothers there. The mothers met with the leadership of the Tamil Tigers who were running the camp. And those local military leaders were quite surprised to see this group of mothers accompanied by a team of a dozen or so international peacekeepers from 8 different countries. And so they sent for their superiors who came in. In the afternoon, we were able to have UNICEF join us on the pretense that there were mothers out in the hot jungle and they needed biscuits and tea. And so UNICEF showed up, and throughout the afternoon, the mothers negotiated directly with the military leadership, and by late afternoon, the children, 28 boys, were released to their mothers with bus fare to go home. That's an example of how the peace force works. Number one, that we are nonpartisan. We are not in a conflict area to choose sides. Number two, we employ effective nonviolent strategies that at least in part rely upon international connections. And number three, we support local people in doing the work as opposed to doing the work ourselves.
Would you explain for our listeners who might not be familiar with the situation in Sri Lanka what has been happening there over the years?
No one can accuse us of headline chasing. By choosing Sri Lanka. Because in the United States, if it's ever reported upon, it's usually on page 6 or 7. Sri Lanka is a beautiful island nation, the size of the state of Wisconsin, off the southeastern coast of India. It's home to about 21 million people. It has also had to endure a civil war which has raged for 22 years. The primary combatants are the Sri Lankan government, which is ethnically Sinhalese and Buddhist, against combatants from the largest minority, who are Tamil and primarily Hindu. It's a war about identity. It's a war about territory, about human rights, about economic opportunity, about religion, and it tragically has claimed over 65,000 people. It is a place where the Tamil Tigers routinely use children as combatants. the median age of the tigers is tiger casualties is age 16. It is also a paradise of an island that is littered with over a million landmines. There has been a ceasefire there for a number of years that was brokered by the Norwegian government. However, peace talks broke down 2 years ago this month and have not resumed. Now, of course, as we all know, the tragedy that Sri Lanka has had to endure was compounded on December 26th by the tsunami.
Well, this is considered your pilot project of the Nonviolent Peace Force. What are the goals for Sri Lanka?
The first goal is that we want to assist in bringing about a peaceful resolution to the war there, and that we would do that by providing nonviolent peacekeeping to the and creating the space for local peacemakers to do their work and stay alive in the process. And so helping to Sri Lankans to build that sustainable base that would support a peace treaty should it ever be negotiated would be the first goal. Secondly, we want to learn lessons from the application of civilian unarmed peacekeeping that we can both use to further our work both in Sri Lanka and in other parts of the world, but also that we can share with both non-governmental organizations, the UN, and other governments so that they can see that there is a practical and effective alternative to military interventions and war.
Now, I know Nonviolent Peace Force began in 2002, and it was a transnational network of organizations and individuals. What were the circumstances that made the transformation of this vision into reality possible?
I think we have to back up a couple of years. The actual organizing for the Peace Force began in 1999 at an international conference called the Hague Appeal for Peace. And at that time, 9,000 activists, political leaders, religious leaders, and others came together to create a practical agenda about how we could do away with war over the next century. What would be the practical things that we would need in place? From that conference, we decided that one of those things would be a nonviolent peace force of trained, unarmed, professional civilians who would do peacekeeping in violent areas. So we started organizing, and what we found, Carol, was that far from being a vision that began in 1999 in The Hague, what we were talking about was really a recurrent vision, a vision of a civilian peace army had been held by many people over the past 50 years. Gandhi was working on the Shanti Sena, which is Sanskrit for peace army, when he was assassinated. But we think he got his ideas from a woman in England by the name of Maud Royden, who had organized a core of people in the 1920s who were ready to go into conflict areas. Unfortunately, she waited for the League of Nations to give their blessing, and that never happened. But this was an idea that had occurred and recurred and was really in the active consciousness of thousands of us around the world.
So tell us about the selection of the site for the first peacekeeping project.
As we were organizing the Nonviolent Peace Force, we almost immediately began receiving invitations. And we only go to areas at the invitation of well-rooted organizations that are indigenous to those areas. By the time we had the convening in late 2002, we had received invitations from 13 different areas. We had narrowed those areas down to three based upon a set of criteria that looked at where could nonviolent intervention be most effective. Then we sent exploratory teams to those three areas, and they did substantial on-the-ground research and connecting with people there. They brought their findings to the convening event of our member organizations in late 2002. And after hearing those presentations and a great deal of discussion and debate, Sri Lanka was chosen as the site of the pilot project.
Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago that you only begin working in a region at the invitation of local groups in that area, and you touched on the significance of that. So basically, you work in partnership with local groups around the world. Is that not true?
That is true. We have to have partners on the ground. Number one, because they're the ones that are doing the work. One of the things that our research showed us is that no one can make anyone else's peace for them, and that the most that unarmed civilian interveners can hope to do is to help protect human rights, help protect human life, and to create that space for local actors to work for peace and stay alive in the process. So we rely upon that partnership. However, I do want to emphasize that we are nonpartisan, and so we are not there to pick sides. That's not our business. In addition to the partnership in the area where the field team is deployed, we also have 94 member organizations of peace and human rights groups from throughout the world who are committed to help in the recruitment, the training, the publicity, and in some cases fundraising for the Peace Force. And because our member organizations are located on each continent, except for Antarctica, we still don't have a member organization from Antarctica, but from every other continent, recruiting through our member organizations assures that we have a marvelously diverse team.
That's just what I wanted to ask you about in terms of the importance of diversity.
A multicultural team, first of all, models tolerance, acceptance, people getting along and working together. I would say more importantly, what we have found is that there are a variety of approaches to nonviolence, and that we benefit from the interplay of, let's say, a person from India who comes out of a Gandhian tradition, working with a person from Europe who might come out of a very tactical nonviolent position, and that we aren't really there to say which are right or wrong. We are say that we are benefited by having that variety of approaches and the interplay of that variety within our teams. Now, Carol, I'm not going to present to you a utopia. It's not easy to have people from a variety of countries and cultures and different genders living together and working together in very stressful situations. That does cause conflict, and we have conflicts that we have to deal with on an ongoing basis.
Mm-hmm. This is Peace Talks. I'm Carol Boss, and I'm talking with Mel Duncan, the Executive Director of the Nonviolent Peace Force. Well, I know before you sent in those initial 15 civilian peacekeepers, a 23-day training curriculum on core nonviolent strategies was developed. Could you describe for us the methods of nonviolent action for conflict resolution?
We identified through a tremendous amount of field research four effective strategies. Because I want to emphasize here, we are talking about field-tested, effective peacekeeping strategies. We are not talking about people going in and wishing and hoping and singing that something will change. We are talking about strategic, disciplined action. The four strategies that we identified that are available in a feasibility study on our website, nonviolentpeaceforce.org, the four strategies include accompaniment, and that is simply unarmed bodyguards. What we found as we worked in various parts of the world was, first of all, there are creative and courageous peacemakers in the most violent places in the world today.
Can you give us an illustration while you talk about this?
In Colombia, the communities of peace that have staked themselves out as non-militarized zones, where neither the paramilitary or the military or the guerrilla are welcome there. That these are zones of peace, and that they are to be kept as such. And what we found cross-culturally is more often than not, that work is being done by women in terms of the on-the-ground peacemaking work. And what those women told us around the world is isolation kills us. If there is not a political cost to our death, we're much more likely to be disappeared. And so accompaniment merely provides a unarmed bodyguard to a vulnerable human rights worker or a peacemaker so as to increase that cost of their assassination. It has worked very effectively in places like Guatemala and Colombia. The second strategy that we found that works is that of presence, which is where larger numbers of trained internationals go to a vulnerable village, for example, or a contested border, and by their presence there and the understanding that they bring the eyes of the world with them, they reduce the amount of violence in those areas. This worked very effectively in Nicaragua in the mid-1980s during the Contra War, when what we found was if there were groups of internationals, especially people from the United States, in villages that were being routinely attacked by the Contra from Honduras, that if there was an international presence, those villages were not attacked for very simple political and public relations purposes. And as we found out later, of course, that war was being directed by the United States CIA, and they were factoring in those public relations and political issues and leaving people alone. So presence is another strategy that has worked, that is working in Sri Lanka right now. A third strategy that we employ is monitoring. This is something that lots of listeners will be familiar with. For example, the Carter Center does this a lot. I think it was probably most effectively used in South Africa during the transition from a apartheid society to an open democratic society, when, of course, it was the South Africans that were doing the work, but they had the support and the monitoring of internationals. The fourth strategy that we found that works is interpositioning, where trained, disciplined civilians place themselves between two conflicting parties and serve as a buffer zone.
So, Mel, perhaps you can describe to us a particular conflict, maybe in Sri Lanka, including the obstacles that had to be overcome and some of the methods utilized to resolve it.
A little over a year ago, there was a faction that split off from the Tamil Tigers, which is one of the two major combatants in Sri Lanka. The violence ensued. Military forces from the main Tiger organization came down to the east and staged against the rebel faction. They staged in an area that was rather remote. However, there were three villages that were between the two conflicting parties. So our teams went into those villages and let it be known to each of, to both of the combatant factions that civilians were not to be drawn in to this conflict and that the villages were to be kept out. And if that didn't happen, this would become an international incident. And in fact, they did limit civilian casualties, and the violence was kept out of the village. Now, there were a whole host of things that preceded that. One of the things that was most important was that our teams needed to establish themselves in those areas and to build trust over a matter of months, not over just a few weeks, but being there and people getting to know them and seeing that they were there for the long term. before that they could be trusted to be called upon. There were also technical kinds of issues. Isolation also is very dangerous for our teams. And it was an area where there was no cell phone coverage. So we had to get satellite phones to our teams so that they could communicate with the outside and make sure that the world did know, and that if we needed to activate our international emergency response network, that we could. It also required a great deal of training and discipline on the part of our team members to know that they were not being evacuated from a conflict, that in fact they were walking into a conflict. And that requires both a tremendous amount of team building and team trust, but also inner work. And that inner work comes from many different places for our various team members.
Well, I read your aim, or the aim of the Nonviolence Peace Force, is to have 2,000 active members in places of conflict around the globe by the year 2010. What needs to happen for this to be a reality? You're talking about training more and more people. 2,000 people, however, are a lot of people.
Yes. It's a lot of people when we think about nonviolent peacekeeping. When we think about military interventions, it's looked upon as a mere pittance. What we need to do is to continue to grow and experiment with peacekeeping, and to let the world know that it's there and that it is an effective alternative. Secondly, we need to develop experience in additional places to Sri Lanka. We have right now active explorations that are going on in northern Uganda, in Israel-Palestine, the southern Philippines, and among the Burmese exiles in India and Thailand. We will be starting one or two additional pilot projects, and at the same time doing the organizing on a regional basis to build up that pool of trained unarmed civilians. We also, though, will need to raise significant money. Civilian unarmed peacekeeping is not cheap. Until you consider the alternatives, then we are a tremendous bargain. However, it costs $30,000 a year to support one trained unarmed peacekeeper. Now, what that includes is their living expenses, their insurance, their training, their transportation, their uniforms, and also a stipend of $800 US a month that each peacekeeper receives. The stipend usually goes either to support people's families or is banked for them when they complete their 2 years of service.
I'll tell you something that astounded me. Actually, it blew my mind in reading in your brochure that the annual cost of the Sri Lanka project is less than what the USA spends on its military in 3 minutes.
We are a bargain. We are the fiscal conservatives when it comes to peacekeeping.
Well, I read an article that you wrote. I hope I can ask you about this. A year ago, your youngest son, a member of the Minnesota National Guard, was called up and sent to Iraq. Is he still there, by the way?
No, he returned after a year.
Well, I imagine it must have been a very conflicting time for you. I can't read into your mind, but just in terms of the work that you do.
It's really been the most jagged contradiction of my life. I love my son dearly. I certainly oppose what he did, and continue to spend every day working for a different approach. At the same time, I do respect the commitment and the sacrifice that he made. The morning that I took him out to the armory, a cold morning in December, which we can have in Minnesota, and I stood there and just looked around at the young men and women, some of them not so young, some of them in their early 40s, who were getting ready to leave for at least a year and to go into very, very violent situations. for something that they believed in that was bigger than themselves. And as I reflected, I realized that those of us working for peace and justice have to be ready and willing to make that same level of sacrifice.
On Peace Talks, we like to give our listeners some practical applications. And I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about some lessons people might be able to draw from these situations that you're talking about, lessons they can apply into their everyday lives.
I think the first lesson is to know that we are not talking about extraordinary human beings. We're talking about you and me. We're talking about the people that are listening, that it is within our capacity to do this kind of peacekeeping work. Secondly, that there are effective peacekeeping strategies that people can use in their own home areas and in their communities. For example, I discussed interpositioning about trained unarmed civilians placing themselves between two armed fighting factions. Interpositioning was happened in my home state of Minnesota about a decade ago when Ojibwe people began practicing their spearfishing rights. These are treaty rights that they've had forever, or they had the rights and then they were allocated to a treaty. When they started to practice those rights on lakes in northern Minnesota, groups of so-called white sportsmen started coming to the docks and started taunting and throwing and yelling and really creating a very volatile situation. So some of the leaders of the Ojibwe people said, you know, we really need a group of trained nonviolent activists who can serve as a buffer. And so we were able to do that throughout that spearfishing season, and it reduced the violence to the point where the sportsmen who were doing the taunting finally just gave up and went home. There are many examples in our communities around the United States where people are vulnerable in their neighborhoods, perhaps are vulnerable to police actions, where accompaniment and witnessing are very important for communities that are under siege.
Mel, if you can tell listeners who are interested and inspired where they can find additional information.
Please go to our website, which is at www.nonviolentpeaceforce.org. And while you're there, buy a peace bond. One way that we support the Peace Force is through the sale of peace bonds at $10 a piece. Therefore, many of us who already have too much material but want to invest in hope in the future.
Thank you, Mel. Mel Duncan is the Executive Director of the Nonviolent Peace Force.
Thank you, Carol.
You can read more about international peacemaking initiatives, hear this program again, and hear more from our conversation with Mel Duncan of the Nonviolent Peace Force, all at our website, peacetalksradio.com. It's where you can hear all the programs in our series, send us comments, sign up for a monthly newsletter, and learn how to support this work with your contribution. That's peacetalksradio.com. Additional support comes from KUNM at the University of New Mexico and from the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico. This program is produced by Good Radio Shows Incorporated, a nonprofit media organization, with information online at goodradioshows.org. For Carol Boss, I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening.